Welcome to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Dankman, in for Larry Mantle today. That's Sheridan Smith singing the wartime classic, We'll Meet Again, at the 75th anniversary of D-Day commemoration in Portsmouth, England yesterday. 75 years ago, U.S. and Allied forces landed on the beaches of Normandy. Close to 2,500 U.S. troops lost their lives on June 6, 1944. Many American soldiers, sailors, and airmen are buried under white crosses and Stars of David in a cemetery on a bluff overlooking Omaha Beach. D-Day veterans who are still alive are now in their 90s, and so this is likely the final major anniversary we will have a living record of what happened that day. I would love to hear from you on this anniversary. I want to hear if you are a member of the Greatest Generation. How do you talk about the war with younger people? Do you think it's important to share those stories now so that they're not forgotten? 866-893-5722 is how to call in and share your stories. And if you're a family member or a friend of someone who served in World War II, how do you keep their memories alive? Do you have a story that you would like to share today? Members of the Southern California community sent many troops overseas during the war. I know that we have a lot of people in our audience who are touched by it. 866-893-5722. You can also find us on social media or on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org to share your story. Now we have some guests to talk about this commemorative event in Normandy. James Holland is an award-winning historian, author, and broadcaster whose work focuses on World War II. His latest book, Normandy 44, D-Day and the Epic 77-Day Battle for France, is released this week in time for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Welcome, sir, and I know it's got to be an emotional time to be in Europe along with so many veterans and world leaders paying them tribute. What have you seen and heard in Normandy this week?
Oh, my gosh, it's been, you know what, it's been absolutely amazing. I got over here on Tuesday. I went back yesterday to Portsmouth for the commemoration there where your president was attending. I came back over on Boudicca, the Royal British Legion ship on which over 300 British veterans were sailing, and we've had the British ceremonies today. And I tell you what, it has really been emotional. It's, you know.
Oh, you know, I'm so sorry. I think that we're having trouble because, again, we're connecting with James Holland in Normandy. We're going to get a smoother connection, hopefully, here in the next couple minutes so he can share his stories. But first, we want to go to the National Memorial in D.C., the National World War II Memorial. Alex Kershaw is on the line, a historian and New York Times bestselling author of multiple books on D-Day, including his latest, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. He's also a former journalist for The Guardian and an honorary colonel in the 116th Infantry Regiment of the 29th Division. Alex, thanks for joining us because I know that you just got done emceeing an event for World War II veterans commemorating D-Day. What have you been witnessing today and hearing from folks who were there, folks who know people who were there? What are you seeing?
It was an amazing day. Washington is very hot and sticky, but we had a very large crowd, and I was extremely proud and honored to be able to read out the names of over 30 D-Day veterans at the National World War II Memorial today. And you wouldn't believe the applause and the cheers that each of those guys received. I think there's a lot of pride, a lot of just a lot of celebration that 75 years of peace and democracy have existed in Europe ever since these guys landed on those fatal shores 75 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, emotions of this day, 75 years past, I'm sure are high with men remembering some of their comrades who lost their lives that day, also realizing that maybe they won't be around for another major anniversary. Did you see in the crowd a lot of veterans who actually served in World War II and served perhaps on D-Day?
Yes, I got to hug and shake the hands of several men who risked their lives 75 years ago. They feel extremely lucky that they survived, unlike many of their comrades. And I think there's a certain poignancy. They know themselves that this will perhaps be the last time that a large group of veterans from D-Day will be together and under the spotlight. So there's a poignancy, there's our intense emotions, but an enormous amount of pride.
Yeah. 866-893-5722 is our number here. We're taking calls from Southern Californians who have family members who served, who are thinking on this day, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, about keeping their memories alive. On the line is Dan in Pasadena. And Dan, I understand that you just had a memorial celebration for a member of your family. What did you want to share?
That's right. Then Lieutenant Second Lieutenant Stephen Warner, Army Air Corps, passed away. He ended up a major, but he passed away on Memorial Day, this last Memorial Day. And we had a memorial celebration for him at his club in Santa Monica in Brentwood. And the thing about that was that he was one of the most distinguished, in my eyes anyway, members of that greatest generation. And he was involved with the capture and interrogation of the first Japanese POW of the war, an Ensign Kazuo Sakamaki. And they became friends, actually.
Oh, wow.
War. That really is an indication of the character of both of those men. But Ensign Sakamaki was a commander of a midget submarine washed up at the edge of Hickam Field. And those two met at that time and maintained a relationship over decades. So there is war, and then there is forgiveness.
And Dan, can you say the name of your uncle just one more time? You know, we're taking calls from folks who are remembering their relatives who served in the war on the 75th anniversary.
Stephen Weiner.
Stephen Weiner.
Weiner, Stephen Weiner, right. At the time, he was a second lieutenant at Hickam Field, and he ended up a major and had a very successful business career afterwards, but much loved in his family and a great exemplar of the greatest generation.
Thank you, Dan, in Pasadena, very much for your call. We're going to go back to Normandy because James Holland is back on the line, award-winning historian and a broadcaster. He's been there and also in England for the past couple of days for these events. And James, just returning to your observations so far of what kind of emotion you're seeing, what kind of stories you're hearing in Normandy.
Sure. Well, Libby, I'm sorry we got cut off there, and I don't know how long I'd been talking before we did. But yeah, it has been an amazing few days. I was lucky enough to be at a reception and lunch for over 100 vets on Tuesday, including many Americans. One guy walked straight up looking as fit and spry as any you like. And he was a naval guy, but on it he was wearing a cap that said Iwo Jima veteran. I thought, wow, D-Day and Iwo Jima, that's quite amazing. Then yesterday I was in Portsmouth for the commemoration where your president was, and today I've been at the British commemoration at Bayeux, and there were quite a few tears. I've got to say, it's been wistful. You know, there's a tinge of sadness here.
And James, I'm curious because we hear a lot in the news about the tensions going on between the White House and the British government and various members of local leadership in Britain. Does it seem as though all these politics are kind of put aside for now and the focus is really on commemorating these veterans and the people who lost their lives?
You know, Libby, I think it has. I think everyone's, certainly in Britain, I think everyone's really relieved to be able to put Brexit to one side, the dreaded B word, and just not think about it for a few days. And one of the good things about the big anniversaries, the noughts and the fives, you know, the 70s, 75th and 80s and so on, is that it does give you a chance to pause and reflect and just focus on something else for a little bit. And it's been great. All the veterans, I've seen maybe 400 over here, which is a remarkable number. When, as you rightly said, they're all in their 90s now, if not older. I was talking to a guy today. He was saved by having a twin pack of cigarette boxes in his breast pocket. He held them up. He's going to be 100 in November.
Incredible.
I'm looking forward to it. It was absolutely amazing, but extraordinary because he just found the gravestone of a guy who he fought with in...
James Holland, again, a little bit of a rough connection, but beautiful stories there from Normandy. James Holland is the author of Normandy 44, D-Day and the epic 77-day battle for France. Alex Kershaw also joined us, historian and New York Times bestselling author of several books on D-Day. His latest is The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. We're still taking your calls. If you have a personal memory that you would like to share, if you're a member of The Greatest Generation, 866-893-5722 to weigh in. Family members of folks who served in World War II or were touched by this war, it's your opportunity on the 75th anniversary of D-Day to kind of take a moment for reflection across Southern California. Give us a call, 866-893-5722. Back with more memories in just a couple of minutes.
We're about 50 feet from the shore. I remember after they were shot, it's hard to remember. You don't linger on death. I remember coming home. I hate war, really. But it fascinates me. I've had friends killed, and I didn't like it at all, you know? Not at all.
That was Jack Welsh, a medic in the U.S. Navy who served on a World War II landing ship tank on Omaha Beach during D-Day. He was part of the 150,000 Allied troops that invaded German-occupied France. That audio is courtesy of a local news station in central Pennsylvania, Penn Live. It's one of the many oral histories that are being preserved because the Greatest Generation is rapidly leaving us. They're in their 90s, many of the service members who are still alive from World War II. We're taking your calls right now to talk about your family members who served. If you yourself served, please call in 866-893-5722 to share your story. And we also have on the line a guest to share a historical perspective, Catherine Landeck, Associate Professor of History and Political Science at Texas Women's University. Catherine, thank you so much for being on Air Talk today.
Thanks so much for having me today, Libby.
What are your reflections, briefly, before we go to our calls, because we do have a lot of listeners who want to share their stories, on a day like today, the 75th anniversary of D-Day, as we know that many of these veterans have left or are older folks who will be leaving us soon, about keeping those histories alive, keeping those memories alive, and the importance of that, what are your thoughts?
Right. Well, I think the fact that they're all in their 90s and our, as you said, our time with them is quite short. It's so important to gather their stories while we can, while respecting their quiet privacy as well. I think gathering those oral histories and doing the work that NPR stations have done and archivists and historians have done is so important. And the fact that so many families are facing the loss of their World War II veterans, if they can save their materials and share them with archives and universities, historians will be able to tell their story long after they're gone. And it's that saving of those materials, letters, diaries, and any oral histories or videos that is so essential to our ability to tell those stories.
That's a wonderful thing to remember if you have somebody in your life that nowadays we have the recording capabilities on iPhones to just flip on voice memo and take an oral history down. And it's a beautiful way to hold on to that memory, either personally or to hand over to a historic archive. Catherine Landeck with Texas Women's University. On the line is Mark in Pasadena. And Mark, I understand you and your fiance just got back from a pretty incredible trip. What were you doing?
We did, yes. So just last year, we found in my grandfather's house, who had passed away about 10 years earlier, that he was a prisoner of war in World War II. And it was a part of his life that he really kept deep down just because of some of the, the trauma that he went through. And when we found this archive, he had kept photos and letters and documents detailing his experience, one that he had never really shared. So we decided that we had to learn more, and we set out to ride our bikes across Germany to retrace his route as a prisoner of war. in World War II.
Oh my gosh. Where in Germany did you go? And did you, you know, see any landmarks or places that he had written about or kept documents about?
Yeah. So we, he was captured near the border of France and Germany during the Battle of Metz, which is kind of, a bit of an untold part of World War II history. And so being there and kind of meeting a lot of the people that are trying to preserve that part of history was just really incredible to see, you know, such a monumental part of the war that I guess isn't talked about as much just because of there was a lot of mistakes made by some of the leadership and a lot of lives lost. And he was part of one of those missions that it was a mission that had a lot of casualties and a lot of prisoners. So he was captured in Metz, France, and then transported throughout Germany because it was towards the end of the war. So as the Germans were pushed further into their own country, they kept the prisoners. So he was marched from camp to camp. So that was kind of the premise of our journey. And we decided to make a documentary about it. So that's the stage we're at now, is going through a lot of that and trying to tell that story.
Oh, that's wonderful. So you're kind of going through doing selects right now. I'd love to have you stay in touch with us as you get that going and you know, take a look at the documentary you put together. I'm sure it's very emotional. Mark in Pasadena, I really appreciate you sharing that and your journey to retrace your grandfather's footsteps. Catherine Landeck on the line. I'm curious, when Mark says that his grandfather didn't really talk about those experiences at the time he was alive, that's something that we encounter. Myself, I report on veteran and military issues in my full-time job as a reporter for KBCC. Many times these memories or these experiences are buried for quite some time. The veteran chooses not to speak on it, or it's too painful, or it stirs up too many emotions. Perhaps later in life they do decide to tackle them, but oftentimes these things stay quiet, especially disturbing experiences from wartime. I'm curious if you have had any experiences in terms of having conversations in a sensitive manner and knowing how to sensitively broach subjects with military veterans who may be still in a zone where they're not able to speak freely about what happened.
Right, right. I think that's a good question. So many of them didn't talk about it when they came back from war, whatever war, because, you know, they lived it. They didn't need to talk about it. They would talk about it with each other, but even not that much, because they just understood. And then as, you know, their children start to ask and others want to know about it, many of the veterans that I've talked with, they believe no one will understand and that they're looking for sensational stories, not the daily realities of it. And so I think if you want to talk to your veteran family members, you know, go into it humbly and sharing that you know you will never fully understand, but that you want to understand as much as you can. And I think the idea of going in to an interview, if you're going to try to do a more formal oral history, doing your research ahead of time so you can ask the right questions and you can follow up with the right questions, that helps them trust you and feel like they know that you're trying, and they're going to be willing to share a lot more of their story if they feel that level of comfort with you.
Yeah, and I think that you mentioned not wanting to be digging for sensational stories. I think that's really key, because people think that you just want to hear, you know, things that might show up in a Hollywood movie or things that are shocking or gory. And going in with a humble heart and thinking about, you know, understanding somebody's everyday experience is really a perspective that can unlock a lot of conversation and trust. Catherine Landeck is joining us right now, and she's a professor of history at Texas Woman's University. We're taking your calls. If you have family members who served in World War II, if you have done research, as some of our callers have, into your relative service, or if you yourself is a member of the Greatest Generation, it's the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and we're taking this moment to take calls from around Southern California to commemorate World War II veterans. Diane in Highland Park joins us now. Diane, you're thinking about your grandfather today. Who was he, and how did he serve?
My grandfather's name was Tony Felix, and he served in World War II, and
helped liberate, you know, camps and, you know, didn't talk about any of those experiences. But then I also wanted to point out, as like a Latino soldier, which for a lot of black and brown soldiers that came back, not only did they have to, you know, kind of deal with the experience of going to World War II and seeing all of that horrible stuff, but also they were denied, you know, GI benefits when they came back, or even if they were killed, a full military funeral because of their race. So I just feel like that's an important part to recognize in their experience as well.
Yeah, and civil rights, that was still a struggle when they returned from World War II as well. Diane, that's such a great point to make. I also have done reporting recently on Latino soldiers in Vietnam who were not recorded separately from their white fellow troops. And so the rate of death for Latino soldiers is believed to be much higher than white soldiers in Vietnam, but the data is still really hard to find. Diane, I thank you so much, and thank you for remembering your grandfather today. I really appreciate the call. Jeff is on the line from Pasadena. Jeff, what story would you like to share today?
Yeah, well, thanks. I'd like to just reflect a little bit on my father, Walter Bjork Jr. He's gone now, but he was in the 95th. Two callers back, the man talked about Metz. The 95th Infantry under Patton were called the Iron Men of Metz. They went in. They were the ones that took Metz back. On the way in, however, my dad, who was just about 20 years old, was shot three times. And when you wonder about how a person's meant to live, the first bullet knocked his helmet off. He put his helmet back on, and the second bullet knocked his helmet off again, creasing the top of his scalp. He was so shocked that he actually yelled in back of him, "Hey, guys, knock it off."
Oh, my gosh.
Just in shock. But they were being ambushed by Germans from in back of them. And the third bullet hit him in the back, hit his ammo belt, shrapnel blew. He lay in a ditch for a half an hour and bled. And they were able to get him out, but
he survived. Jeff, can you mention your dad's name and once again where he served?
Walter Bjork Jr., Private First Class, 95th Infantry under Patton, in World War II, and he was wounded in France. But they weren't as psychologically sensitive back then, so when they found out he was an artist, to help him recuperate from his trauma, they assigned him to draw horrible wounds of soldiers being wounded. So a lot of the soldiers today at least have a little bit more sensitivity.
That's certainly true, Jeff. I thank you so much for your call. We are taking calls from folks who are remembering their World War II service members and their family, maybe friends, people they've done research into, or if you are a member of the Greatest Generation, call us at 866-893-5722. It is the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and we're taking an hour to reflect here on Southern California's service in the Second World War. We'll be back with more from our guest, Catherine Landeck with Texas Women's University. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today, back after this break. Welcome back to 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today. It is the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, the Allied and American invasion of German-occupied France that really turned the tide and led to the eventual defeat of Hitler and a victory for the Allied forces in World War II. We are taking your calls at 866-893-5722 to weigh in on your memories of World War II, on your memories of the Greatest Generation. And we actually have a member of the Greatest Generation calling in right now. Bernard in La Mirada is on the line. Hi, Bernard. You fought in World War II. What do you recall, and where did you serve?
I was in the camp was between Yeovil and Taunton in Somerset on the north side of the channel. And because of a mix-up, I didn't go in on the first day, and I wound up nailing dog tags to wooden crosses. And then I was angry, but I soon cooled down when I remembered that none of those dog tags were mine.
So you missed going into Omaha Beach, which became one of the areas of greatest losses for American troops. You missed that by one day, Bernard?
Yeah, by a few days. Our unit went in later on at D plus seven.
Wow. And so you yourself had to go in and nail dog tags because of how many losses. Do you recall if you knew any of the people who were lost that day? Bernard, did you lose friends?
Yeah, I lost a very close friend that I grew up with in Chicago.
And I'm sure on a day like today, you remember that friend and think about his sacrifice. What branch did you serve in, Bernard, and where did you go after coming to the beaches of Normandy?
I went to I wound up in Italy, which was a still cleaning up the army remnants at Tumbolo, Italy, in Tuscany.
And how do you commemorate? Bernard, I'm so sorry to interrupt. I'm just curious, on a day like this, when you were thinking back 75 years later to the invasion of German-occupied France, how do you remember a day like today? What are your thoughts, and how do you commemorate the losses of your fellow troops?
Well, the losses were enormous, and they were all brave guys, you know. And I was just, like I said, I was angry that I didn't get into on the first day, but I did serve later on, you know.
Angry? Why, Bernard? Why angry?
Because it was a mix-up. I would have gone in on the first day and probably have been killed, really, you know, because there were so many casualties on the first day.
But you feel, is there a level of guilt having not gone on the first day? Is that why you would, I would think that for most people it would be relief that you weren't on the beaches on that day.
But, you know, you train to do things, and if you were prevented from carrying them out, it became a problem. But then as I was nailing those dog tags on the wooden crosses, I realized that none of those dog tags were mine.
Yeah. Bernard and La Mirada, I thank you so much for your service and also for sharing your story. It's so important to hear your voice today on the 75th anniversary. Thank you, sir, for your call.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Bernard. Also on the line is Colette in Malibu. We are talking with service members and their families about the 75th anniversary of D-Day. We're taking your calls at 866-893-5722 to weigh in. Colette in Malibu, you have a father who's still with us, I understand, who served?
Yes. In fact, he turned 100 2 weeks ago.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yes. And he served in Egypt, so they were protecting the Suez Canal, not often talked about. And that is where he met my mother. And she will be 99 this year. They've been married 75 years. They got married there, and then he had to return to active duty. So he hadn't seen his new bride for about a month. And
oh, Colette. Oh, no. We just lost her. She was hanging on for so long. Colette in Malibu, thank you for calling about your dad. Happy birthday to him. And I hope that we can hear the rest of the story eventually. Thank you, Colette. Nancy in Pasadena is on the line. Nancy, you have several members of your family who served. Please share their stories.
I do. I'm so grateful. I don't even know where to start. There's so many wonderful stories. But General Frank McCarthy actually ran World War II. He was the aide to General Marshall. And Frank was the life partner of my uncle Rupert Allen. And Frank did not see any days of the war because he was running. I mean, he didn't see military action. But he did end up making the movie Patton, which won 7 Oscars, because he had gone to VMI with General Patton and he knew all of the generals. And he hired a young screenwriter that had just won the UCLA Screenwriting Award named Francis Ford Coppola.
Oh, yeah. Heard of him.
He wrote the scripts, and Frank wanted a young writer because he wanted to make the story accurate. And so he did, and that went on to be a wonderful movie. Now, Uncle Rupert, who was his life partner for 42 years, was a conscientious objector who ended up serving in naval intelligence for every phase of the war. He was in the Pacific, in Africa, and he had a piece of D-Day information that he had to deliver, but he had the pink eye and was in the hospital. And they told him if he left that he would potentially go blind. But he got up anyway to go to the base to deliver his piece of the information, and we still have a framed card, his framed naval intelligence card that deals with that. We have a lot of their memorabilia, and I would like to find some place to donate it.
Oh, that's beautiful. Nancy in Pasadena, your connection with especially the movie Patton, which I think really shaped our understanding of war, at least in popular culture. Thank you very much, Nancy, for your call. And Colette, you just got back on the line. Colette, please, quickly, what story did you want to share of your dad who just turned 100 and served in World War II?
Exactly. He was stationed in Egypt, which is where he met my mom. They married there. He went back to active duty, and they were separated for, you know, about a month. He was granted a furlough. He was about to board the plane to see his new bride after a month, and his superior yanked him off the plane and said, "Sorry, soldier, I got to get on this plane. Tough luck for you." Turns out the plane crashed. Everybody died on the plane. And then he was able to return, of course, and see his wife and spend 75 years together. And they are both still with us. She's 99, he's 100, and they just celebrated their 75th anniversary.
Beautiful. Colette, thank you so much calling from Malibu. Nancy in Seal Beach, thank you for calling in about your dad. I'm sorry we couldn't get you on the line. Father who served in World War II and grew up in East L.A. during the Depression. Nancy in Seal Beach. And Ned in Pasadena, also thanks for your call. Again, we're talking about the 75th anniversary of D-Day. I thank everyone who shared their memories of World War II service members. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today. More after this break. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Hey there, I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today. Thanks so much for being with us. This hour, we're going to talk about the economic recovery, how it's going, and what lies ahead for U.S. workers and businesses. It may seem like our economy is firing on all cylinders, but a new forecast says the future of the Golden State may not be quite so sunny. The UCLA Anderson forecast released its quarterly report yesterday, and it even raises the possibility of a recession on the way for the national economy. Here to break it down is Jerry Nicholsberg, director of the UCLA Anderson forecast and professor of economics. Thank you very much for being here, Professor.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, sir. You released your second economic report for 2019 yesterday, and you write in this new report, quote, "Although growing, the economy is weaker than it looks." Why is that, sir? What are you observing?
Sure. So this refers to the national economy, and you made a statement a moment ago that it seems like California is firing on all cylinders, and in fact, it is firing on all cylinders. But the latest GDP numbers, so this is for the first quarter of 2019 for the U.S., came in at 3.1%. And there was a lot of celebration about that. That was faster than expected. But when you look behind the numbers, you see that consumption in the U.S., and that's 70% of GDP, did not grow very fast. So you have a buildup of inventories because people are nervous. They're starting to save more and they're spending less. And so the underlying fundamentals of economic growth that would give you a 3% growth rate this year simply aren't there.
I do want to talk about the California picture in just a second, but on the issue of GDP growth and the other factors that you consider, what are the markers that you're looking at in your forecast? You mentioned consumption patterns. I imagine issues like inflation are factored in. What are the factors that you consider when you put together a forecast like this?
Sure. So there's a whole variety of measures that we look at, but certainly job growth is one of them, and job growth by industry. What, you know, which industries are growing and what is driving the economy? Investment, and investment really has not been very strong in spite of the promises of the recent change in the tax law. So we have relatively weak investment, and then we look at the increased uncertainty with these new trade wars and saber rattling about international trade, particularly as it affects the supply chains with Mexico, that uncertainty affects the willingness of businesses to invest. So there are, you know, a variety of factors that we look at in formulating our forecast, and we put those into an economic model that relates all of these together and says how they fit to create the economy.
And again, at the national level, what does that mean for the future, for the next couple of years? Will we start to see job growth decline further? Will we see any issue with wages, any impact on the average worker? What is your expectation for the next couple of years for the national economy?
So we want to be clear about what it means when you have slowing job growth. We're going to have slowing job growth because we are basically in the neighborhood of full employment. And that means that we can only get job growth when we get labor force growth. And that comes about organically. That's a slower growth than when you have a large pool of unemployed. So that's a good thing. You want to be near full employment and have slower economic growth. What is troublesome is when you have slower economic growth because the economy is contracting. But that slower economic growth we're expecting through this year. We see fairly healthy signs for the economy and a lot of inertia. There are elevated risks, particularly with related to trade wars. But as you get out into 2020, all of our models of the likelihood of a recession start to spike. And so 2020 looks like a much riskier year in terms of positive economic growth.
And you mentioned that low unemployment is a good thing, but there's also repercussions with a tight labor market, right? What does that mean for businesses? What does that mean for the kind of growth that they can expect or investment that they can make in their own growth if they are dealing with a tight labor market and maybe difficulty finding workers to hire?
So in a very real sense, that's good news. If you have a tight labor market, it means that firms have to bid for workers. And we've gone through this expansion with very little increase in wages. And now we're starting to see wage growth. And we expect wage growth through this year and into next year. So that's actually a very healthy sign that this increasing inequality that we've seen, you know, through the expansion thus far may be starting to reverse as labor markets tighten.
Yeah, because for so long we were hearing, yes, the economy is booming, but we're not seeing it in real wages. And so this may be, a continuation of real wages actually ticking up because of that tight labor market. To look at the California picture, to look at statewide, we have record employment levels. All indicators that we speak about in the media seem to say that the world's fifth largest economy is doing quite well. What does your forecast see? What kind of factors are you looking at statewide? And what do you see in the next couple of years for California?
Sure. And that perception, unlike the perception in maybe some other parts of the country about California, is correct. California has been growing faster than the rest of the U.S. It's one of the fastest growing states, even faster growing than Texas, although I think people in other parts of the country would be surprised to hear that, and continues to grow faster. We, through the first 4 months of this year, California has been growing at a rate faster than 3%. And the tightening labor markets is going to slow that growth. Right. So we have in the Bay Area sub 4% and in some cases sub 3% unemployment rates. And we have unemployment rates in many counties in Southern California that are at or below the U.S. rates. And that means we're running out of people. And that means that we'll have slower growth, although we'll have better income growth than the U.S. But this very rapid growth that we've been experiencing, that just necessarily has to slow down.
But does that mean that California is headed for recession the way the national picture is looking to you? Or is that simply a balancing out, a leveling off of the incredible growth we've been seeing in the state?
The two risks that we see to the forecast are in California's close relationship with Mexico and China in terms of international trade and then and international tourism. And so the recent trade tensions, are definitely of concern. The other is that we have seen a softening in the housing market, and we're not getting an increase in permits. In fact, we're getting a decrease in new building permits. That affects construction, and construction has been a growth area in California in the last couple of years. It also affects the quantity of housing that's available. So that is going to have an impact on migration and on the ability of California's labor force to grow to meet the increased demands for labor on the part of business.
We're speaking with Jerry Nicholsberg, director of the UCLA Anderson Forecast, and their second quarterly forecast was released yesterday. Professor Nicholsberg, I'm curious, the housing bills that went down to defeat in Sacramento last week got a lot of attention in the media. I'm curious, when you talk about regulation and the number of new homes being built, was that factored into your forecast? Regulations we thought we would see easing up in Sacramento, but in fact, a number of those bills went down to defeat or were tabled.
You know, private sector building has been, in response to market signals, soft housing markets, has been declining. And the number of permits has declined by 20%, now at a run rate of less than 100,000 a year. So these bills were not going to affect home building in 2019. We're expecting regulatory reform in California and have that built into our forecast for 2020 and 2021. So we're expecting a pickup in home building in the state. And so this year's legislative defeats by such bills as SB 50 are not really a factor, we think, in the long run trend in home building in California.
It's a fascinating conversation, Professor Nicholsberg, Jerry Nicholsberg, with the UCLA Anderson Forecast. I thank you very much for explaining the report that came out yesterday, looking at the national picture, maybe some trouble ahead for the national economy. We're going to continue this conversation in just a couple minutes, talking about the effects on workers and also the economic forecast for the state of California with trade tensions looming, back in just a couple of minutes. Hi there, it's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. We just spoke with Jerry Nicholsberg about his latest forecast from the UCLA Anderson School, looking at the indicators for the national economy, potentially a recession on the way in the next few years, or at least recession risk going up in the next few years. And locally in California, the way the tight labor market and trade tensions are affecting the economy. Now I want to welcome Chris Thornburg to the show, founding partner of Beacon Economics and director of the UC Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development. Chris, thanks for being on Air Talk. I'm curious about your take on the Anderson forecast, the conversation about the risk of recession going up in the next few years. What are you seeing in the indicators that you pay attention to with the national economy and a potential slowdown?
I think in general, we have some broader agreements with the Anderson forecast in terms of their worries about stressors on the economy. The lack of labor force, driven in turn by a lack of housing in the state, is obviously slowing things down. That's not really a forecast. That's just the trend we've been on for the last 2 years.
Those are just the facts.
Hello?
Yeah, you're saying it's not a forecast. Those are just the facts that are in front of you that you're interpreting.
Already, exactly right. So we think that those are right. I think our primary point of disagreement with the UCLA folks is on the state of the current economy. They have, like many other folks have, painted a fairly dismal picture of where our economy is. In fact, I would note that you started this segment out by talking about where we are in the terms of the recovery. Well, the recovery is long gone. This is not a recovering economy. It hasn't been a recovering economy for quite a long time. This is an economy that's actually doing very well at many levels, wages, quality of life, manufacturing. at so many different ways. The U.S. economy today is really one of the most dynamic growing economies in the developed world. And that's, I think, is going to be one of the primary factors that's going to help us weather the storm that Donald Trump is creating through these various trade things.
What's your take on the tight labor market? We heard about the Anderson School's forecast relating to California and companies having trouble finding qualified workers in some sectors. What's the effect on workers and on business when you have such low unemployment and high levels of employment?
Well, it obviously puts stress on businesses who want to expand here. Every company's having trouble finding people. And believe it or not, the biggest shortage is actually for low-skilled folks, because those are the folks who are most likely to move out of the state because of high housing costs. And so it isn't necessarily tech companies and professional services that are having trouble finding folks. There's plenty of lawyers out there to fill those positions. But talk to hotels, talk to restaurants, and getting somebody to clean the floors and get the dishes washed is becoming more and more difficult. And it's those core service jobs that fuel so much of the service industry here that are so critical to parts, different aspects of our economy. The one upside of that, of course, is, believe it or not, over the last 3 years, the biggest or highest pace of wage increases, income increases in the state are for people at the low end of the skill distribution. You're seeing a faster pace of pay increases for people without a high school degree than for people with a bachelor degree in the state. So there is an upside that these families that for many years were under a lot of financial stress are really finally starting to get ahead in the context of this incredibly tight labor market.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that the recovery is long gone. I think the reason that sense kind of hangs around is because for so long wages felt stagnant and were stagnant compared to the booming growth that we were seeing in other areas of the economy. But yeah, you're saying that this tight labor market is creating an upsurge on an upward pressure on wages, and that's giving you said low-skilled wages, yeah, in California some juice.
Let me push back a little bit on that, because the biggest issue has been the continued pushing forward of the myth that wages haven't been growing. The wage data we have that Jerry's referring to is lousy data. It's got all sorts of statistical problems to it, and anybody who knows that data understands you can't look at it. The Atlanta Fed has a fix. They call it the Atlanta Fed Wage Tracker, where they fix all that busted data. And once you control for inflation, it turns out over the last 5 or 6 years, real median wages have been growing about 2%. Average real wages have been growing close to 4%. That's substantially better than the last expansion. And this has been going on for a while. So, in fact, wages have been rising and going up for any number of years, which is what's been supporting ongoing overall consumer spending growth, which has been very strong in the United States. And then let's go to the next step. What we're missing here completely is all the non-purchase consumption growth in our economy. It's really important to remember that wages are a horrible metric to measure quality of life. You know, at the beginning of the Great Recession, in the run-up to it, in 2007, something else fairly monumental happened. The first iPhone came out. You know, we still live the Great Recession, and yet we always assume we had a smartphone in our pocket. That's not true. The smartphone is only 12 years old right now. And the reason I bring that up is anybody in their smartphone in their pocket can pull that phone out, and on that phone they have an infinite amount of free entertainment and free information, abilities to communicate. This thing opens up worlds of potential consumption that's completely unpurchased. And none of that is in these statistics. And 85% of Americans have these. 50% of people in rural developing nations have these things. This is a game changer from a quality of life perspective. It's not in the stats. And there are 100 other examples of changes in our world that aren't counted in these data. We really need to get off the woe is me bandwagon. Appreciate just how good we have it today, Because if we don't, if we continue to wring our hands and pretend things aren't fantastic, then we allow the kind of populism that Donald Trump brings to the table to take over politics and push all the bad policies that we need to be avoiding.
Chris Thornburg, founding partner of Beacon Economics and director of the UC Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting. I want to take your temperature. Weigh in with us at 866-893-5722. What are you seeing in this booming economy? Have you seen a difference in your own work life with the labor market really tight? It appears that there is some upward pressure on wages. Have you seen your own fortunes changing in the last few years as this economy continues to be strong? We are also talking with Kate Bischoff. She's on the line from Thrive Law and Consulting, an employment law and HR consulting firm based in Minneapolis. And Kate, I would love to hear your take on what Chris is saying, that we have a negative view of this economy. There's maybe some messaging problems with what's going on. I, as a millennial, you know, look at my inability to buy a home and, you know, to do a lot of things like pay off student debt as part of my quality of life. So maybe we have to factor those in as well, in addition to consumer patterns, consumption patterns. But what are you seeing in terms of the way that employees are being impacted by this economy? Are they able to negotiate, for example, for higher wages because of a tightening labor market?
Absolutely. We're seeing a lot of negotiation around wages, whether you're a current employee asking for a raise or coming into a new position and trying to negotiate wages. And on the flip side of that, we see a lot of pressure for employers not to do those things, not to negotiate wages, but try to find other ways to entice people to either come to work for us or to stay to work with us because of the pressures about the gender wage gap and other pressures that HR is feeling to try to do better in society as a whole.
So what does that mean in your, you know, decision-making process? What kinds of things should an employee keep in mind in this type of labor market? You know, if you're looking for a job and you, for example, you know, want to get into a certain sector, but maybe you don't have all the skills at hand, but you know that there's a big demand in that area.
Well, one thing I would do for sure is, given what the UCLA report showed, that there's potential for a recession coming down the pike soon, is as an employee, look at where your employer or the employers that you're looking for need additional skills, and then compare them to what you have and see if your current employer will help train you to get into new positions. Because we have such a tight labor market, there is a huge force for employers to look internally to see where can we train people to fill those jobs that we just aren't able to fill. And that means employers have increasing training budgets. They're looking to find ways to be creative, to get people those skills that they need so that they can stay with us and grow with us. So as we look at where jobs are in demand, it's not just at the low skilled wages that the previous person discussed, but it's kind of everywhere. We're looking for better people and better skills to see where we're going to go next. So take a look. Where could you be? What kind of skills would entice you to learn? What do you want to be doing? And then see if your employer will help kick in some money to help develop you to that point.
Kate Bischoff with Thrive Law and Consulting, thank you very much for being on Air Talk. And Chris Thornburg, I'm just going to give you the last word because I opened up a can of worms on, you know, millennials and purchasing power and home ownership, you know, everything that kind of gets factored into quality of life. Any final thoughts you want to leave us about this economy and the way we should read financial headlines that are kind of doom and gloom sometimes? Sounds like you're saying that that's not accurate.
I sum it up with one word: miserableism. The ongoing philosophy of pessimism that has taken grip of this nation. Look, there are issues out there, and millennials are falling behind relative to older generations, but at some modest level. But again, at the same time, they do enjoy perks of life that you and I could have only dreamed of when we were kids. So I think that we need to, again, stop the national pity party, appreciate what we have, and work on the real issues.
All right, Chris Thornburg with Beacon Economics. Thank you, sir. And I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. No pity party here. We're going to be back after this short break. Oh. boy, I hate talking over Mariah. Hey, it's Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. We're listening to that because there was a new movie released on Netflix last week. You may have heard of it. Comedians Ali Wong and Randall Park star in Always Be My Maybe. It follows the reunion of two childhood friends who grew up next door to each other in San Francisco and the possible rekindling of their romance after many years apart. Let's hear a clip.
Sasha Trent!
Mr. Kim, oh my God!
Oh, wow. Look at you!
You have not changed one bit. How do you not age?
I washed my face with shampoo. I can't believe I'm seeing you. We thought you'd never come back. You're like our own Asian Oprah.
Oh.
How much money do you have now?
He's serious.
Oh!
That was Randall Park briefly at the end there. His dad in the show is just a really delightful character. Speaking with Sasha, who is played by Ali Wong, who's now a really famous chef, and she's come back home for a little while. And hijinks ensue from there. The movie is notable not just because it's hilarious and emotional and at least temporarily revives the struggling rom-com genre. It's also a romantic movie with two Asian American leads. And there's a wonderful piece in the Huffington Post this week about how the movie's portrayal of working class Asian families in the 90s in the Bay Area, it allows some audiences to be seen for the first time in a popular film. Right now, the author of that piece is with me. Marina Fang wrote the story for Huffington Post, and she joins me on Air Talk. Hey, Marina, thanks for being here.
Hi, Libby. Thanks for having me.
So I loved the movie. I loved Always Be My Maybe, but my experience of it was really more framed by its 90s pop culture nostalgia and the love of When Harry Met Sally that I still hold in my heart. It's my, sad day movie every time I'm homesick or what have you. But for Asian Americans, it's an important moment of representation. Can you tell me about your feelings while watching Always Be My Maybe and what really stuck out to you?
Yeah, well, I should say I also love When Harry Met Sally and was also brought up on a lot of really great rom-coms. But I think what's significant is that, you know, they, Ali Wong and Randall Park, really set out to make a When Harry Met Sally for Asian Americans because, you know, we are not, we haven't really been represented in this way before. This is a movie that's not really about Asian identity. It's really just, you know, a rom-com that happens to be about Asian Americans. And so that's really significant. And as we talk about how Asians can be better represented in pop culture, certainly something that has come up a lot because of Crazy Rich Asians, it's really refreshing to see a story that is about Asian characters, but the central tension or the central plot developments aren't really tied necessarily to the fact that they're Asian.
You know, I really want to hear from listeners on this topic as well, because I think that not everyone realizes the emotions when you are in a category that isn't always represented as the norm in pop culture, the way that straight white America is, what it means to people to see themselves represented or reflected in movies or TV shows. Give us a call right now, 866-893-5722, to weigh in on this topic. I'd like to hear from you if you have a movie in mind. Maybe a show or a song or, you know, a comic book, anything that has made you feel seen for the first time on a larger platform. Tell me about that at 866-893-5722, about what it meant to you, what the piece of art was that really saw your culture, your identity reflected for the first time, and what that meant in your life. Marina Fang is on the line from Huffington Post. You mentioned Crazy Rich Asians. Of course, that's the other phenomenon that happened last year. Movie with a mostly Asian cast that really broke a lot of barriers in terms of popular romantic comedies. But compare and contrast, because Always Be My Maybe is a really different type of film, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for one thing, I would say it's Crazy Rich Asians, a lot of the conflicts in the movie still really focus on Asian identity, because we see the contrast between Asian Americans, Asian people who've grown up in America versus people in Crazy Rich Asians' case in Singapore versus Always My Maybe, which is about Asian Americans who are from San Francisco. And so that's a very different experience. We also see working class Asians portrayed. One of the main characters, Marcus, he and his dad work for, they run like an HVAC business, which is not something you really see, especially with East Asians. So those characters are Korean American, and often on screen you see Korean Americans or Chinese Americans or Japanese Americans portrayed as like very economically successful. When we talk about the model minority stereotype, for example, that's kind of what we're getting at. And so it's really refreshing to see not just a range of Asian characters and Asian voices, but also within Asian identity, we see like diversity in economic class.
Did it surprise you? Did this movie, for me at least, it came relatively out of nowhere. I know that there was some coverage ahead of time, but in comparison to the expectations that were kind of heaped on Crazy Rich Asians, I felt that this was really just a beautiful thing that, you know, showed up with some fanfare in our feeds. It came into people's living rooms, and it was just this really beautiful gem of a sweet, funny, romantic comedy that, again, transported us to the lives of Asian Americans in the Bay Area in the 90s and today, but it's slipped things in there so subtly because this was really just a human story that contained that representation. Did it come out of nowhere for you, or was it on your radar already, Marina?
It was on my radar in part because Netflix, which released it, had been advertising it fairly heavily. It's also been in the works for a while. It actually came, the funny story behind its origin was actually, I think it was in The New Yorker, Ali Wong was interviewed and just briefly mentioned how she and Randall Park, who they've been friends for a long time and also worked together on the show Fresh Off the Boat, she was a writer. And actually the director of the film, Ninochka Khan, also helped create Fresh Off the Boat. So she'd mentioned kind of offhand that they were trying to create a When Harry Met Sally for Asian Americans. So it's actually been in the works for a long time.
Oh, so this was a pretty transparent process then, if she's talking to The New Yorker about that idea. Just briefly, because we only have a minute left, Maria Fang with The Huffington Post, we can't get past the issue of sex in a romantic comedy and the fact that Asian American men so often not depicted as the romantic leads in, you know, sexual situations. That was not the case in this movie. And, you know, may I just say the name Keanu Reeves and leave it at that. Any final thoughts on, you know, what that representation means and what Always Be My Maybe means for Asian Americans?
Yeah, that's a great point that you mentioned. There are so many moments in this movie that really subvert stereotypes about Asian Americans. You know, I mentioned the economic class earlier, but also, you know, Asian men are often portrayed as sort of desexualized, and Asian actors, male actors, often talk about not getting to play romantic leads, and we see that.
Yeah, I'm so sorry that we're running out of time, that Ali Wong successfully subverted, as you mentioned, Marina Fang, in Always Be My Maybe, subverted that stereotype about Asian men. It's a great movie. I recommend it. I love the conversation. Marina Fang with Huffington Post. I'm Libby Dankman, in for Larry Mantle today on Air Talk. Thanks so much for listening.